So tonight, when we turn to chapter 4, again, if you're not using Cheryl Ford, you don't have necessarily the same chapter numbers. But Christian, after being instructed with those seven illustrations in the interpreter's house, Christian goes on his way, and he's going down this highway with walls on the sides of him. And the wall is, according to Bunyan, called salvation. That's a reference to Isaiah 26 there. And so Christian, still with his burden on, begins to run up the highway, but it was very difficult because, again, he had that burden on his back. One of the things that's impressive, though, when you read something like this is, again, this is obvious, but there's a point I'm making. What is Christian doing in this first scene? What was difficult? What did he begin to do up the highway? He was running, right? Now again, was it hard? Yes. Why was it hard? Because of his burden. But what can you tell about Christian here as you see him? Even though it's hard, he's still running up this highway. You can tell that he really does want to find answers. He really is doing everything he can to get solutions to his issues. Christian knows what's up ahead and it's driving him to run, even though it's difficult. And so Christian runs on his way until he comes to this higher ground, where there stands a cross. A little way from the cross is a what? An open grave, depending on what version you're reading, what translation you use. And so Bunyan says he saw in his dream that Christian, as he approached the cross, what happened to the burden? It fell off. What else? Rolled down the hill and went where? Into the open grave and was never to be seen again. Now we've tried to make it clear, or I at least tried to make it clear, when did Christian actually get saved? Yeah, a few months ago. When did Christian actually become a Christian in the story? When he entered the gate. That's the objective marker. Right there is where he became a Christian. Now what's odd about this story is his burden remained with him. And that's what causes a lot of people to have problems. And then you come to this scene, and some people say, well, this is where Christian really became a Christian. And it's not, because we said that the burden is his burden of sin. It's the feeling that he had. And again, this is where Christian is a strong representation of Bunyan. Again, this is not meant to make anyone feel odd, or there's more of you than it's going to sound like. But this kind of a testimony is not normal. Most people don't live with long-term guilt after they become a Christian. It's usually when they become a Christian, they realize they've been free and they feel it to some degree. But for Bunyan, and therefore for Christian, there was a long period of struggle and doubt even after he became a Christian. Bunyan writes in Grace Abounding, he writes of a 2 to 3 year period of struggle after conversion. So Bunyan gets saved and for 2 to 3 years wrestles with his own salvation. Now again, I'm saying that's not normal, not meaning it's weird. I'm meaning normally that it's not how you experience it. Almost every other character in Pilgrim's Progress Part 1 and Part 2 is different than Bunyan, than Christian here. Christiana loses her burden right away. Hopeful lost his burden right away. They all lost their burdens right away. But Bunyan held on to his, and therefore in the story, Christian held on to his. And one person phrased it this way: whenever you have childbirth, what is born every single time? A child. Now, are they all born the same way? Not really, right? There's a lot of variations along here. There's a lot of complications, a lot of surgeries, there's a lot of variations with each childbirth. But in the end, each time, a child's born. And they were saying that's wise for us to remember, because when the scripture talks about being born again, you want to remember that there is uniqueness probably to a lot more cases than we realize. Your experience of how you came to know the Lord and how you came to assurance does not mean that's the normal Christian experience. And so if someone's, this sounds so bad in our day, if someone else's experience is different, it doesn't make it wrong. Now, in our culture, people will take that and twist it and go, see, the Muslim experiences peace with God. And that's not what I'm getting at all. But Paul's road to Damascus experience is such a stark contrast that some of you that don't have that wonder if it's real, because it's not what Paul went through. That's what I'm getting at. And so Bunyan clearly struggled with his 2 to 3 years of wrestling with assurance. And you see that reflected here with Christian. Now, if Christian had continued in error and ignorance and neglect, his burden would have remained. But as you watch the story, he gets converted. He goes through the house of interpretation. He goes through those 7 clear lessons. He's being discipled. He's being taught. And then right after that, he gets back to the cross and his understanding grows. And as an understanding grows, his experience of salvation grows. Christian's not more saved now that the burden's gone. He just feels more saved. He experiences more joy from it. And so again, even in our own conversions, each person is different. God's word has to be the standard for what a conversion has to look like, not our experiences. And so Christian goes up to the cross. His burden snaps and rolls away into the grave to be seen no more. Later on in the book, he has this conversation with Piety. I think it's chapter 7 or 8, I forget. And he actually says, "I saw him hanging on the cross." Now, whether or not he was physically on the cross in the dream, I mean, now we're getting into some like 4-layer dream material here. But whether or not he physically, Christian, saw him on the cross, or just when I saw the cross, I could see what Jesus did. The point being, it was his contemplation of what Christ did on the cross that caused his burden to roll away. Again, I want you to notice that studying the atonement is what led Christian to gaining such clear assurance and joy and excitement. Again, a lot of times this is taught here in our church, and I wish more people would catch on to this, but we study theology because it really does impact your experience. So many people chase experiences by getting around theology. I don't want to do the hard work of study. I don't want to do the hard work of learning and listening and reading. I just want to feel better, or I just want to be more excited. And that's not the way that God set this up. Romans 12, you know this verse, be transformed by the what? The renewing of your mind. And as that mind gets renewed, your thinking is changed, and now your experience is changed. You interpret data differently. You look at reality differently. And so Christian contemplates the atonement, looks at the cross, and he is excited. He notices from the cross that the sight of the cross brings complete deliverance. I think of John 3, where, you know, a lot of people know John 3:16, but 14 really rolls into 16 because Jesus is compared to the serpent. And what did Moses do with the serpent? He raised it up, and the promise was anyone who does what? Anyone who looks to the serpent will be healed. And then you hear about believing in Jesus. So this idea of looking to Jesus and believing in Jesus is the same thing. And Christian looks at the cross by faith. He contemplates what Christ did. He realizes Christ bore our burden so we don't have to. And as soon as he sees that blessing, joy comes and the burden snaps off, rolls down the hill into the grave. Again, following from his renewed mind, his mind that's still being renewed. Right after that, Christian standing there weeping and watching, and then 3 shining ones, 3 angels, suddenly appear and greet him. They say, "Be at peace." The first one tells him his sins are forgiven. The second one takes off his dirty, nasty clothes and covers him with clean clothes or righteous clothes, shining clothes, new garments. And then the third one gives him a what? Gives him a scroll and tells him to, study the scroll, present it at your arrival to the celestial gate. And so that scroll is going to become a main part of this section, so just keep that in mind as we move on. But I want you to think of how hard Christian would have been rejoicing now after this experience. Think of how hard it would have been for him to leap for joy with that burden still on his back. Think about how much harder his journey would have been with that burden still on his back. Think of how much harder it would have been to fight Apollyon later when we get there. With that burden on his back. Again, not meaning he wouldn't be a Christian, but meaning he's not experiencing what he could be experiencing. He would just give more thought and time and effort both to praying, "God help me," and also renewing his mind through studying the gospel and the word and different truths like that. That's a great question. Does this show or tell what the mark was? I don't have a ton of clarity on what the mark is, besides God marks his people off from the world type thing. I don't know if it was like it wasn't an ash cross on his forehead. I know that. It wasn't a birthmark or anything. I mean, I just don't know. It doesn't say what the physical mark was, but he was marked, and it's kind of a separation type thing here. And so Christian is now clothed with his bright new garments. He's rejoicing, he's running, he's leaving. And then he comes along and he meets three men. What are those three men? What are their names? Simple, sloth, and presumption. Go to Proverbs 1. I'm going to read just a few Proverbs that explain some of these characters. I told you one of the critiques of Bunyan's work here is allegory usually is you have to think and figure out who somebody represents, but he just calls them the thing. Simple represents somebody who's simple. Slothful, somebody who's slothful. And presumption, somebody who's presumptuous. He makes it pretty easy. But simple being this idea of spiritual dullness. So Christian's walking on this path and a little bit off the way. So not completely away from the path, but not quite on it is the imagery here. He meets these three men and they are fast asleep. They have fetters on their feet. And the first one is simple, spiritual dullness. Look at Proverbs 1:22. How long, O simple ones, will you love simplicity? And scoffers delight in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Look at verse 29. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Verse 32. For the turning away of the simple will kill them, and complacency of fools will destroy them. And you see this guy who's simple. And it's the idea of simple-minded, just not very bright, not very discerning. You're not catching when good is called evil and evil is called good. You're not picking up on that. When someone says go left and you should go right, you're easily deceived. It's this idea of this turning away from the fear of the Lord and going your own way. Proverbs 14:15, we'll be in Proverbs a pretty good bit tonight. Proverbs 14:15 uses this another way. Says the simple believes everything, but the prudent one discerns his steps. I mean, you think about kids. When you're raising kids, I remember one guy joking, I mean, you could teach your kid anything. You could say 2 + 2 is chair, and if that's all they hear, they don't know any better. But the idea is you learn truth so that as people come along and tell you more and more as life gets further along down the road, you're able to have discernment because I've grown in what the truth is. The simple person does not do that. The second one, slothful, is this idea of spiritual lethargy. This is the attitude of, I'll just do it later. Not necessarily disagreeing with your idea, but just not right now. You think about Proverbs 12. It talks about the one who somehow was able to get game. So they have an animal, but they refuse to do what? Do you remember the proverb? Let's look at it. Proverbs 12:27. Proverbs 12:27. A slack-handed man does not roast his prey, but the wealth of a man is precious for the diligent. So, I mean, imagine someone who's hungry, and somehow they attain meat. And they just go, I mean, all this lighten up the grill. And, I mean, I'd like to eat, but I'll do that later. And this is the picture here. You have Proverbs 22:13, a little bit more well-known. The guy would go out and work in the street. But listen, there's a really good reason he's not going to go out today, and that's because of what's outside. There's a lion outside. And it's like, well, that is actually a great reason to stay inside. If what? If there was a lion outside. I'm putting my money on there's not a lion outside. So one of the ideas you get from Proverbs of these spiritually lethargic people, sometimes their excuses make a whole lot of sense, and they're still just bad excuses. Not every bad excuse is like a bad excuse, meaning that makes no sense. Yeah, if there's a lion outside your house, you just stay inside. Great, no worries. And that's what Proverbs 22:13 is getting at. Then you have presumption. This is the idea of just spiritual haughtiness, pride. You're going to see him be independent, not needing other people. So Christian approaches them, and he asks them questions. You know, what are you guys doing? Do you not realize the danger you're in? He talks about the one who goes around like a roaring lion is going to come, and you're going to be prey to him. There's no way you'll survive his teeth. One commentator on Pilgrim's Progress said, the allusion here is to 1 Peter 5:8, where your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Thus, authentic Christian pilgrimage is more biblically and realistically portrayed as a hazardous expedition rather than a leisurely, blissful pathway that offers frequent periods of pleasurable repose. And the idea, meaning this is a dangerous way to live your life. This is a dangerous way to go about your days. And so Christians trying to wake them up to the danger that they're in, especially if you're just laying down, sleeping on the side of the road. And so then they look up to him. And the first one, simple, says, I don't see any danger. Why do you think he doesn't see any danger? Imagine if I have no clue what a lion is, and a lion walks up to me, and I go, I don't see the problem with him walking up to me. Why do I not see any problem? Do I? Yeah, I'm simple-minded. Do you not know what a lion does? No, I don't, actually. What do they do? Oh, they have teeth? Are they like meat? I'm made of meat. This might be a problem. And so the more you learn, the more you realize, yeah, there is danger. But this simple fella sitting by the side of the road, and Christian says, you guys are in danger. And he goes, what danger? I mean, he's just oblivious to what's going on. And then secondly, you have slothful, or sloth. He yawns, which is appropriate, as he says, I just want to sleep a little bit more. The proverb that says a little sleep, a little slumber. Lazy people usually don't tell you they want to sleep all day. They usually tell you, I want to sleep a little longer, and a little longer just stays a little bit longer until it just never ends. Again, another commentator on this part with slothful, he said, I'm sorry, with simple, not seeing any danger. Go back to simple, not seeing danger. He said, it was not weakness of his intellect, nor his youth, nor his inexperience. There is danger enough, no doubt, in all these things if they are not carefully attended to. In our experience of him, that is simple, we cannot get him, all we do, to read an instructive book. We cannot get him to attend our young men's class with all the baits and traps that we set for him. And so the commentator is getting this idea that this guy doesn't know anything and isn't doing anything about it. And then again, you move to move away from simple to slothful. And again, another Horner commenting on this says, too lazy to study the word and persevere in the faith. He rests upon some decision in the past, which deludes him into believing that his place in heaven is secure. His perception of himself at the present world is misguided. He is mainly concerned with his own well-being and sensual contentment. This world provides a relatively harmless environment. He's undisciplined, ill-prepared, self-indulgent. And one day, when it's too late, he's going to finally wake up to the reality of his own poverty, paralysis, and misery of his soul. And this is the one who says, look, I'll worry about those dangers later. And he says, just a little bit more sleep. Then you have presumption. That's basically a mind your own business attitude. He says, look, I'll do me, you do you. I mean, again, you see this everywhere today. The moment you bring a little bit of a correction or a little bit of a rebuke or a little bit of instruction and it pricks people, they'll say, well, hey, how about you just worry about yourself and I'll worry about me? And again, that's his attitude here. But the question remains, what about Hebrews 13:17? Where every Christian is expected to have shepherds that look after their souls. And if you don't have that, you're assuming you don't need shepherding. And again, that's what this guy's doing. So all three men lay down, they sleep again, and so Christian just keeps going. Again, they remain ignorant, they remain satisfied with filling the flesh, and they remain, you know, high on their own stock, if we can phrase it that way. So Christian is walking away, but what do you notice about Christian as he walks away? When he thinks about those three men, what comes over him? He's troubled. Why would he be troubled? Yeah, I mean, he's really saddened by this. Like, you guys really don't get it. You know, I'm walking away from these guys going, they're toast. Like, that lion's going to come by, and they don't stand a chance. So Christian's walking away. He's upset that he offered free help to them. I'm here to help you. And they just ignore him. Not only that, when he did awaken them, he offered wise counseling, but they ignored him. He offered to take away their fetters or their chains, and they ignored him. And one person said, the most blind person out there is a person who just refuses to see. I mean, that's what you're dealing with here with these three people. And so Christian's walking away troubled by these three men, and then he meets two other men, and what are their names? Formality and hypocrisy. And how do we meet these guys? How do they get onto this way that Christian's walking? Yeah, they jump over this wall, and you go, hey, that's not how you get on this pathway. And that's what Christian does. He sees these guys climb over the wall that was earlier called salvation. So they enter this pathway of salvation the wrong way. And you see that even from Bunyan's description. Formality can be called a performer, and hypocrisy can be called a pretender. Formality is one who's religiously interested, like Bunyan was. Remember, he loved those church bells. He loved the high church material. He loved a lot of things about church before he was a Christian. And so formality is religiously interested, but it's all external. Hypocrisy is someone that's a religious pretender in this case. For this person, congratulations drive them far more than Christ does. And again, another commentator, he said this, "Look at the religious formalist at family worship with his household gathered round him all in his own image. He would not on any account let his family break up any night without the habitual duty. He has severe method in his religious duties that nothing is ever allowed to discharge or in any way interfere with. As the hour strikes, the big Bible's brought out. He opens where he left off last night. He reads the regulation chapter. He leads the singing and regulation psalm. And then, as from a book, he repeats his regulation prayer, but he never says a word to show that he either sees or feels what he reads. And his household breaks up without an idea in their heads or affection in their hearts. He comes to church and goes through public worship in the same wooden way." Again, it's something that we've got to remember. Like, it's really hard when you think about, biblically, the signs of life for a Christian can be copied by non-Christians. So let me ask you, do Christians love their Bible? Yes, do unbelievers love the Bible? Can they love the Bible? They absolutely can, right? I mean, think about how many conservatives in McPherson are upset. I don't know if this is the case now or not, but just do the Ten Commandments still stand in the courthouse? Do you know, Cheryl? I don't know. So this is not in reality because I'm not sure what's going on. But let's just imagine they're there and imagine there's a vote to take them out. Do you think the outcry against that would be higher or less than the number of Christians in McPherson? In my understanding, there would be more people than are Christians that would be upset at that. Because there's more people that love Bible things and Christian things than love Jesus. And so the point that I'm getting at is there are real signs of life. Christians love to go to church, but unbelievers can love to go to church too. Christians can love to sing hymns and spiritual songs and Christian songs. Unbelievers can listen to those same songs and also be affected in some sense. And so you see that with formality and hypocrisy, one performer, one pretender. And it says in the passage, I'm a creature of habit, in verse whatever line we're on. Bunyan writes, "So like I said, they caught up with him and the three began to converse." So Christian's walking away from those three men. These two men jump over the wall and run up and catch up to Christian. And I could not leave this out. Spurgeon said this. It's a little bit longer, but on his commentary on Pilgrim's Progress, he said, Bunyan says they caught up to Christian. It had taken him a long time, Christian, to get where he was, but they caught up to him in a minute or two. None seem to grow so rapidly as those who have no roots, and who therefore are not really growing at all. A child with a farthing's worth of soap and a pipe soon blows big bubbles, painted with many colors and sparkling with beauty, but they're only bubbles. They're very quickly produced, and then they speedily vanish. Beware of getting a sham religion. You can easily paint and grain a piece of common wood so that it will be taken as oak or sandalwood, but it would take many years to grow the genuine oak and many months to bring the sandalwood from the far-off land. To imitate a good thing may be rapid work, but it will not last. You who catch up so soon with older Christians, mind that yours is personal experience and not as much as learned from books or picked up at an experience meeting. When a man has nothing to carry, he can run quickly. Empty drums make great sounds, and brooks that are shallow flow at a great rate. So formalists and hypocrisy quickly caught up to Christian. And again, what a warning that is, that we've interacted with this kind of an idea at Cornerstone before. People will come in, and one of the come, and it'll be phrased different ways, but people will say, I feel behind. And they'll say, man, I feel like the last 10 years I haven't been learning what I should, or 30 years, or 40 years, or whatever it is. I mean, they'll say, I feel behind. And the danger is, well, don't try to catch up too quickly, because you may turn into that fake piece of oak. You may try to appear to be something you're not. And I remember early on, just my interest in theology, reading books, and I was able to parrot a lot more things than I actually understood. I was able to copy certain answers to certain questions, and it wasn't until later I go, oh, that's what that means. And so I'm not telling you to be lazy, I'm not telling you to do anything like that, but understand, you don't have someone who's born and hangs out with a 15-year-old, and the newborn's supposed to immediately act like a 15-year-old. When you're born again needing nutrition, needing growth, needing to be progressed to solid food and things like that. And again, you hear that warning from Spurgeon, and I couldn't leave that out. So Christian is approached by these two men, and he asks them, where have you come from, and where did they come from? The land of vainglory. And where are they headed? They're headed to Mount Zion. What do you know? Just like Christian. So he says, well, why didn't you come through the gate like you were supposed to? Don't you realize that in John 10, that's me adding that, Jesus talks about people who jump over the wall? And formality and hypocrisy answered, well, you don't understand. We were going to, but what was the problem with the gate? I mean, we got way back there. I mean, do you realize how far down the road you are? We just jumped over the wall. It's a lot easier than going that long way to that gate way away. And so they have a reason for them for this. They also say, we took a shortcut because that's the usual way for us. For these two people, custom and convenience determine truth. Think about that. Custom and convenience determine truth. And so Christian is troubled by this, and he says to him, but since you're violating his revealed will, won't this be viewed as trespass against the Lord of the city where we're going? And then they told Christian, well, there's no need to worry. And the reason is because what? Our people have what? We've done this for 1,000 years. Well, that means you have a 1,000-year-old problem. What's the point in saying how long you've been wrong? They, again, are banking on custom and convenience. They say, if need be, we know people back home that could, or up ahead, wherever they are, that could bear witness to the correctness of this approach. Oh, you don't think we're legitimate? We'll find people to vouch for us. What does that matter if the Word of God disagrees with them? Answer it for me. Yeah, if you interact with Mormons at all, they'll describe this experience called the burning of the bosom. And you'll never be able to explain to them they didn't really experience reality, because they experienced something, and that gives them validity. How do you know you're right? Well, I know I'm right because I had the burning of the bosom. It's like, yeah, but God's Word disagrees with you. Doesn't matter. I know what I experienced. These men say, well, we've been doing it this way for 1,000 years. And we'll find other people who say they know we're right too. And Christian is not convinced by that. He says, will it stand up in a court of law, formality and hypocrisy, telling that, yeah, over 1,000 years we've been doing this. Some people think that's Bunyan's way of referring to the Roman Catholic darkness for the 1,000 years that kind of took the Bible out of people's hands, drove them into spiritual ignorance. And so they say, what does it matter as long as we get into the way? Who cares how we got here? In other words, they're saying, look, we're living like Christians. Who cares how we got on this path? Who cares what the gateway we used was to get in? We're on the road with you. And so they're appealing to the wrong authority. Christian knows from his book that he is learning more and more about that they're wrong. And he tells them, I'm walking according to the master's rule. You walk according to your own vain imaginations. You guys enter as thieves. You enter without his direction. And you're going to be sent out without mercy as well. Again, they didn't have much to say to Christian after this, except, again, they just repeat this idea of mind your own business. The author here says, then I saw the three men. They walked on without much discussion with one another, except the two men told Christian that as to the laws and decrees, they would doubtlessly obey them as consciously as he has. Therefore, they said, except for that coat on your back, which we trust was given to you by some of your neighbors to hide the shame of your nakedness, we don't see how you differ from us. They just recognize the major difference between the two of them. What does Christian have that they don't? A coat. And what did we learn earlier that coat is? What was removed before that coat was given to him? His filthy rags were taken away, and in their place was this new garment that's shiny and bright and right. Okay? So they're admitting, we don't have that. What are they telling you they don't have right now? They don't have the righteousness of Christ. And Jesus said, unless your righteousness, what? Exceeds that of scribes and Pharisees, you won't enter the kingdom either. You don't get in without this coat. And they just said, Christian, the only reason you have that coat is to cover up your shamefulness. It's like, oh, if you only knew. You're exactly right. And you are still wearing your shamefulness, actually. And it's not going to work out well when you get to the gate. And so this is the difference that they recognize with Christian. Again, Christian is swift to reply to them. He says, since you didn't come in the way that you're supposed to, you're not going to be saved by these laws and decrees that you make up. And this coat on his back, he talks about as the righteousness of Christ. I'm just jumping through the story. And so he explains these things to them, how he got the scroll, how he got the garments, how he got all this. And he says, though you need these things, I doubt that you have them since you didn't come in the gate. Go to 1 Corinthians 2. This is what we keep encountering as Christian has talked to these five guys. You have him talking to the three men that were asleep. He woke them up, warned them. They went back to sleep. You have these two guys who jumped over the wall the wrong way. He warns them. They ignore him. And so 1 Corinthians 2, look at verse 14. But a natural man, even one who jumps over a wall and is walking on the same path you are, but a natural man does not accept the depths of the Spirit of God. Why? For they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually examined. Christian is speaking to them from his book, and what he's speaking is wisdom, but they hear him and think he is a fool. Where does the problem lie? In their hearts. It's how they're hearing Christian that's the problem. Of course you think this is foolishness because you're still dead in your sins. And so Christian is pleading with these people and nothing's being done because they're still blind and dead. So formality and hypocrisy have no answer to what Christian's been saying to them. They look at each other and they laugh. Again, another sad scene. They continue on their way. They go ahead of Christian. Christian goes ahead of them. He knows 1 Corinthians 15 that bad company corrupts good character, good morals, depending on your translation. So he gets away from these guys. He's leaving them with sighs. He genuinely hurts for them. And he also has to give himself words of encouragement. Why do you think he'd be walking away from this needing to encourage himself? Yeah, but he's walking off by himself now. He's sighing because he's sad about them. And then he speaks encouragement to himself. Why would he need to do that? Yeah, this is the fifth rejection in a row. At some point, you got to ask, am I the crazy one? Am I the oddball here? So those three guys thought I was crazy, and they sure looked rested. These two guys are taking an easier path. Am I really making things harder than they have to be? And I can't tell you how many times that thought crossed my mind as I'm trying to figure out my way around and learn theology and learn how to apply what you read in Scripture. And so Christian is encouraging himself. That's why it's important for you to preach to yourself. David talks a few times in the Psalms about what he said to himself. I said, soul, and he's talking to himself there. So then they keep going. They eventually arrive to this place where there's three ways to go. One is the hill of difficulty, and the other two around actually are easier, is something for you to catch. It is easier, but why is it not worth it? Why are those two other paths, even if they are easier, why are they not worth it? Because they lead to death. You're going to die. You got a journey that won't be as hard as the hill of difficulty, but your eternity is going to be miserable. Why not be miserable on the way to an eternal bliss is the idea. And I don't mean miserable as in Christians can't be happy, but that journey's hard. And so the other two take the other routes, hypocrisy and formalist. are certainly going to avoid difficulty. I mean, they believe, but not that much. I mean, they're not, you know, extreme Christians. That's the way that a lot of people put it. And what a lesson for us to just remember that comfortable doesn't always mean right. I mean, you take those other routes, and there are ways that those routes are easier. That hill of difficulty, the further up you go, it's almost like the more you keep going, the higher and steeper it gets, and it's hard. But again, comfortable and easier is not always right. And so Christian eventually abandons them. They go their own way to never be seen again. One of the guys pointed out that those two men, and really every guy that we've encountered so far, has rejected these four things. They've rejected instruction, admonition, counsel, and rebuke. And I want to read Proverbs 15:10 for you. Just in light of that, you think of how they rejected instruction, admonition, counsel, and rebuke. Proverbs 15, verse 10 says, that is 14:10. 15:10 says, grievous discipline is for him who forsakes the way. He who hates reproof will die, is what Proverbs 15:10 says. The one that hates reproof will die. So let me ask you, if you've watched Christian interact with these five people, how has Christian interacted with people that needed help? He walks up on three guys sleeping. He's joined by these two guys who cheated. How does Christian express his concern for them? What does he always, so far, begin with? So how did he begin to address that issue? What did he first do? And I'm not looking for wording. I'm looking for a style of a sentence he used. He asked them questions. Hey, where'd you guys come from? Hey, do you guys know the danger you're in? I mean, he starts off with these questions to help pry the answers out of them, to help lead them to water, to mix illustrations there. He matches those penetrating questions with truth as well. And that's usually where the company parts ways. The questions aren't nearly as offensive, it seems, as when he just starts telling them what reality is. And that's where they draw a line, and the three guys are going, you move along. These two guys are going, you move along. They don't want to have anything to do with him. And so Christian keeps going. He goes up the hill, and again, this is odd comfort, but it's comfort that comes from Scripture. The difficult journey ought to be encouraging to Christian, because that difficult journey means you're on the right road. Does that make sense? Sometimes we long for an easier road to walk down, and you go, well, that actually wouldn't be good. Because the road that leads to death is wide and easy, is what Jesus said. The one that leads to life is narrow and hard, and few find it. And so Christian's walking up this difficult hill. It gets more and more difficult. And as he's traveling, he starts crawling. The hill's so steep, but Christian's so convinced of what he's read, he's going to keep going up the mountain anyway. And then he comes to this place called Pleasant Arbor, is what Cheryl Ford says. He comes to the Pleasant Arbor. And what was the design of this place? What was the purpose of it? It was halfway up the hill of difficulty to do what? To give rest to the traveler, right? Now, just as an obvious question, is rest bad? No, but like any good thing, what can we do with it? We can have too much of it, right? Food's not bad, too much is. You look at sleep's not bad, but too much is. Interestingly, I don't think the Bible ever tells you to sleep. It just assumes you're going to do a good enough job. It tells you to get up several times, but that's another message. So Jesus, even in Mark 6:31, commanded his disciples to rest. So the critique here, don't hear Bunyan critiquing rest. This place was built by the Lord in this story. It was built by the Lord to give rest to pilgrims. So Christian goes to the place. He takes out a scroll like he was told to do. He studies it. He benefits from it. He learns from it. And then he does what? He goes to sleep. Now, the first three guys he met in this chapter, what did he rebuke them for? What were they doing? They were sleeping. And now what's Christian doing? Now, a difference, so he's not like a total hypocrite. A difference is, why is Christian sleeping? Because he's tired. It's a hard work, right? Why were those first three guys sleeping? Because they're slothful, they're simple, and they're presumptuous. Christian's sleeping because he's just tired. And another difference is when he's awakened, he repents. So the someone comes alongside, they point him to the ant. We'll get there in Proverbs eventually. But I'm convinced of this understanding. When Solomon tells the guy to look at the ant, where are ants usually? On the ground. So he's telling a lazy guy, look at the ant. Where do you think the lazy guy is? On the ground. It's like, look, dude, if you'll just open your eye, it's right there in front of you. You don't have to go anywhere. That ant crawled right up in front of your face. Just look at him and learn from him. Again, we'll get there in Proverbs 6, but Christian's told to learn from the ant. So he jumps up, he takes off, and then as he's running, he encounters two more men, timorous and mistrust. What does timorous mean? Sounds like timidity. I don't know how they're related, but what does it mean? Nervous, to be afraid, frightened. What does mistrust mean? I'm not trusting, right? I'm doubting. So these two men come running back to Christian, and what's their concern? Christian, don't go any further, because what? Now, were there lions up ahead? There were. So were they wrong? No, they were telling the truth. There are lions up ahead. But what's Christian's logic back to them? Why does Christian go, no, guys, it really is worth continuing? I love this part of the story. What is Christian's logic on why you should keep going? Yeah, it's like, guys, we can go back to see destruction. We're certainly going to hell. I can keep going forward. I might get mauled by a lion, but I'm going to heaven. It's like, certain hell, possibly mauled by a lion. And that's the way Christian makes his decision. And so these two guys come, they run at Christian, they're telling him to turn around, go away, and they're not wrong. There is danger up ahead, but Christian says it's worth it. That danger is worth it because I know where we're headed. And again, Bunyan talked about these two lions. In a sermon he gave on Psalm 34:10, he talked about these two lions being the wicked of the world who don't fear God. It was a play on a proverb in their day about being destroyed by a lion, and he incorporated it here. And so Christian talks about how scared he is, but then he gives that logic that I was just talking about. And as he's going on his way, what does he realize he now doesn't have? He lost his scroll. And in the story, what does the scroll represent? What doctrine would this scroll be covering? So not security, what? Assurance. Somebody tell me the difference. I want to make sure we're clear on this. What's the difference in security and assurance? One is like steady, the other one wavers, right? Security for a Christian is immovable. Does assurance vary? Absolutely, right? Everyone would be on a roller coaster. Some of you are on a lot easier one that doesn't go up and down too much. Other ones, I don't know how they get all those twists and turns in such a short period, right? I mean, it's all over the place. Everyone on the roller coaster ride is secure. You're not going anywhere, but there's some turns where it's like, I feel like I'm falling out. And so the difference is experience versus objective reality. So Christian loses his scroll. He loses his assurance. At this moment, he's wondering, oh no, I'm not going to get in where? I'm not going to get in the gate. I'm not going to get in. That is the idea of him losing his assurance. And so finally, he turns around. He goes back to get it. He's repentant, he asks for forgiveness, confesses his sin, he's beating himself up. And I want you to notice, all of this is due not to a sin of commission, but a sin of omission. Christian didn't technically do anything wrong at that arbor. He just didn't do what he was supposed to. And so you see here how laziness can play into a loss of assurance. Galatians 6 talks about reaping what you sow. And Christian, through negligence and laziness, had sown these seeds, and now he's reaping it. So he's having to run back, and he talks about that. By the time he starts going back again down the path, he's done traveled this road 3 times now. And so Christian is going. What should have been just a little bit of rest ended up turning into sinful slumber and sleep. And so finally Christian goes. He searches for it. He finds it under the bench wherever he was sleeping. He gets it, he's rejoicing now, and he goes back on his way. And finally, he meets right outside this place called Beautiful. Right outside of that, he meets the two what? Yeah, and one of the things that hit me as I was reading it, think of how close mistrust and timorous were. I mean, those lions are right outside that place, Beautiful. and they turned around. One of the guys pointed out that it was just one trial too many for them. They were good. Think of all that Christian's been through. They were good all the way up to that point. And I was like, you know what? This is too much. And they turn around and go back. Remember the context of Bunyan's day with the church and the issue of conformity and the Church of England and things like that. There were a lot of people that knew they should get out of the Anglican church. And they wouldn't do it. They would get close to doing it. And the closer they got to actually getting out and going into a nonconformist church like they should have, the closer they got to it, the closer those lions came and the more it scared them into staying. And so Christian, now with his scroll, runs up. He sees the two lions and he's immediately, what comes over him? How does he feel? He's terrified. And I love that. Like, I'm glad Christian's honest here. Like, I don't believe him if he sees two lions and is not moved. I mean, he's scared, but he knows what's not an option. It's not an option to turn around. I don't want to go to hell. I mean, these lions terrify me, but that's worse. So Christian is staring at these two lions. He sees what mistrust and timorous told him about. And again, the place called Beautiful, a lot of people think that that was Bunyan's way of representing a nonconformist church. And so the watchman comes out and he's like a pastor leading this place called Beautiful. And when people should have been going out, they had to go by these two lions to get in. And again, most people agree the two lions would have been the civil and the ecclesiastical or Church of England authorities. I mean, imagine if by default you're enrolled in the Church of America, right? And then by conviction you go away from that. You've got civil and ecclesiastical authorities breathing down your throat. When you left that church, you were against the city and the church, and you were going to this place that was not recognized as a church at all, this nonconformist group of people. And so Christian's walking up, and these two lions are there to intimidate him to stop and don't enter into this place called Beautiful. What does Watchman come out and tell Christian? Do what? They're chained. Did Christian see that? No, he couldn't see it. So Christian's reality, again, I hate the way this gets abused today, but from Christian's perspective, his reality is, those lions are going to crush me. The guy in the place called Beautiful, the church, the nonconformist church, he knows something Christian doesn't know. And what does he do to him? What does he do for him, I guess? He uses his mouth to do what? To tell him. He talks to him. Let me tell you what reality is. Let me talk to you. And that is used for Christian to gain the confidence he needs to walk through this deadly row, if you will, with the two lions on each side. I bring that up because a lot of those people that struggle to make the right decision, they just need somebody that's in a real church to tell them, no, reality is not as you're perceiving it right now. You think that those two lions are going to destroy you. They're not going to destroy you. You don't realize how good it's going to be if you can just come through those two lions and get to this beautiful place. And again, Bunyan's illustrating that obedience is sometimes dangerous and hard, and you need other people to come alongside and remind you of what reality is, remind you of what truth is. That's why we need local churches. Then he tells Christian he's not seeing reality the way that it is. Those lions can't devour you. They can't because they're chained. And so imagine what kind of faith it's going to take to walk through these two chained lions. Does anybody know what a lion's breath smells like? Anybody? Anybody want to volunteer to find out? And so imagine walking, you got these two lions here, you're staring at the white of their eyes, you smell their breath, and they're right here. And the only thing that's going to get you through that is what? So walking straight, but why would you do that? Because you have faith. But again, we make faith so just obscure and blob-like. What do we mean? Faith is trust. What is this guy trusting? He's trusting that that guy was telling him the truth, that those lions are what? Chained. It's like, okay, you said they're chained. I can smell their breath. I can see their eyeballs. I'm going to keep walking because I believe what you're saying. And so, again, I'll ask it from another angle. What's the proof that Christian believed what the guy said? he walked through. If he just said, look, yeah, they are chained. You have a good day. Well, you don't believe me. Faith would have borne the fruit of walking through. And that's what you see with Christian here. He walks through. He's encouraged by the watchman who comes out and tells him that. And he walks down this dangerous path. So I want to end with just asking. By the way, Christian, he gets through. He's rejoicing. His hands go from sweating to clapping. And it's a great ending to chapter 4. But I want to pitch it to you guys. In Bunyan's day, you had the civil and the ecclesiastical lion there breathing down the throat of those who would dare to enter into a biblical church. I want to ask you what two lions, and we can have 10 lions, I don't care, what lions are there today to intimidate people from going into a biblical church today? Okay, yeah, so we live in a culture of wokeness. We live in a culture that is crazy and backwards. They reject God, and we've been doing it for so long, it just gets crazier and crazier. I keep saying, I can't believe blank, but I ought to be saying, I can't believe when something wise happens. That's what I can't believe. I can believe the foolishness that keeps growing and increasing. But yeah, there's cultural pressure where, you know, I heard your church believes blank. It's like, oh yeah, I don't go there. So that definitely happens. What other lions intimidate people? Yeah, so internally, those lions can be something internal to me. And you know what? That place, it just doesn't jive with me. It's like, well, what does the Bible say? I don't care. And I've literally had a meeting where someone said, this thing y'all did upset me. And I said, well, what do you think this verse means? And they said, I don't care what that verse means. It's like, then I think our conversation's over. Like, I don't have anything to say. Like, if you don't care what the Bible says, what do you want me to do? And so, yeah, you have internal and external. What are some other internal, external issues that keep people from diving into a healthy church? Yeah, churches have reputations. Churches have roots where families have dug deep, right? So back home, I've noticed it more than out here. A last name is more tied to a denomination than I've noticed out here, but maybe I'm just missing it. But if you tell me somebody's last name, I can most of the time tell you what church their family goes to. And it's hard to tell your family, hey, I'm going to go somewhere else. That is difficult, and it keeps a lot of people from doing it. I've had conversations, again, with people back home. You don't understand. I can't leave my family's church. Okay, I think Jesus said something about that. Didn't he? Did Jesus say anything about loving him versus your family? What did he say? Yeah. Yeah, and I'm only critiquing someone convinced they should make a different decision, but they're not because of family. I'm not critiquing people who weigh the situation and go, you know what, I would like to be there, but it makes more sense for me to stay. I can see that. But there are churches that people are in where you know you should get out, you know Jesus wants you to get out, but you tell Jesus no because mama's not going to be happy. And it's like, look, I want to make mama happy. I love mama, but if Jesus says this, I think Jesus said something about that. I mean, it is difficult. It is very hard. I'm not acting like it's easy. No one likes to be disliked. If you do, that's a different animal in itself. No one loves that. You don't wake up and go, who could I get to not like me today? And when those people are closest to you, it's even more uncomfortable. But that's certainly family and friends and reputation is another lion out there. Give me some more. What are some other reasons that people go, you know what, I would make that decision, but what? It's inconvenient. They're moving their church service to 9 a.m. Are you kidding me? They don't even have a smoke machine. I don't even know what. Yeah, no, it's inconvenient, right? There are tons of inconveniences. I mean, one that's popping in my head right now. It's inconvenient for me to go there because I had an awkward situation years ago, and I don't really want to show up again because people might say X, Y, and Z. It's like that is a lion outside screaming at you, trying to keep you away. I think of cults. I think of sects and denominations that have so inundated people with their theology and philosophy of life that they see biblical churches and they go, no way you should go there. Have you heard what they say about women pastors? Have you heard what they believe about the Bible? They believe every word's true. Like they think Paul speaks for Jesus. Can you believe that? And so those are lions outside that keep people from joining biblical churches. You think about politics. Oh, that's a MAGA church, or that's a whatever church. And you have left and right both that keep people from joining certain churches. You have social activism. You have the idea of evolution. I mean, you can't go to that church because they believe God created the world in 6 days. They believe that the earth is young. And you have those kind of intimidating things. You have science. We talked about this before, but back during COVID, we were told, you guys are going to kill people. It's like, well, we know where they're going. Like, no, I'm just kidding. That wasn't the approach we took. But I just look at people who value, and I'll just say it, they value what Fauci says more than Jesus. And that is a terrible lion sitting outside of a door. Now, I'm not saying ignore science. That is not my point. But when Jesus speaks clearly, if my life is threatened by that, my life is threatened by that. There's a lot of things that your science isn't going to agree with, like an empty tomb. And so, again, you see all kinds of things sitting outside the church. And then again, I said internally, how could pride keep people from joining a biblical church? Yeah, I want to go there. They expect me to do stuff. I like this place because it's so big. People don't really notice if I'm there or not. I can get it in and out. They got a bunch of stuff I can attend. But then people start asking me questions. It's like, I don't really like that. Yeah, you're going to get confronted. How could self-sufficiency keep you from joining a biblical church? Yeah, the lion stands out there and roars, you don't really need this place. You're good. I mean, look how blessed your life is. Obviously, you're doing something right. Now, you think about the flesh. The flesh will keep you away from a biblical church, especially in line with the same thing. If I go there, I know that they're going to help fight my sin that I don't really want to fight, and I want to hang on to my flesh, so I'm going to stay away from there. You think about worldly priorities. What are some worldly priorities that would keep you away from joining a biblical church? Getting involved with is another way to say it. And they're not necessarily bad priorities, but just you're arranging them in a worldly way. Family. Yeah, just to be blunt, the whole canceling church for Christmas thing. We're going to take a non-biblical holiday, not un, but non, Bible doesn't mention Christmas, and we're going to use that to tell Jesus we're not going to listen to you when you tell us to assemble because we want to value the family. Say, Jesus, I'm so glad you were born. For your birthday, I'm not going to listen to you and go be with your people. I just don't get it. And again, there's an easy priority of the family where, well, those are my family evenings, which prioritize family. Like, you need to take care of your family, but your family needs the church. So there is a way to do that as well. Think of things that aren't wrong. Again, prioritizing family is not wrong in and of itself. I'm just picking a sport. You play baseball. Playing baseball is not wrong. When baseball overtakes your commitment to a local church, it's wrong. You take anything in life that could be that. Work is good, but work can easily creep in and take over someone's life in a local church. Again, we've mentioned this before, but even the cost that's too high, there are decisions people make involving their church that sometimes they make the decision just because it's the easiest price to pay. If I made this decision that I know is right over here, it's just a high cost and I just don't want to foot that bill. I don't want to pay that. And so again, just take some time to think through even yourself what lions are out there keeping you from being involved more and more in a solid biblical church. Any other comments or questions on what Bunyan was going through here? Again, there's a lot to cover. We did a decent job of getting through that. Any other comments or questions? All right, well, let me end on a chapter that dealt so much with assurance. I just wanted to offer some help. There was one book I couldn't find in my office, so that means somebody in our church has it. So I hope you're enjoying it. No, it's okay. I can replace it. I wanted to offer you some things that have helped me think through the issues. And it's not always a book on assurance. A lot of times it's a book on the gospel. So I think of, what is the gospel? Some people, some genuine Christians lack assurance because they just don't understand what the gospel says. So this would really help. Another one that we've talked a lot about is this gospel primer book, where it's short meditations on the gospel that you can remind yourself of each day or each time you pick it up. Another way to get help with assurance is understanding what conversion actually is. What does it mean to become a Christian? Because if I don't understand what it means to become a Christian, I'm certainly going to lack assurance on being a Christian. And here's another helpful book on conversion by Michael Lawrence. And then the other ones that are more geared towards assurance, I'll start with the one that you'll all love and appreciate, this little thingy right here. Not every Christian itches in the same spot, and these books scratch different places, so take it for what it is. Jeremy Pierre wrote, "How Can I Be Sure I'm Saved?" That would certainly get you headed in the right direction. And then you have this one by Mike McKinley, "Am I Really a Christian?" I'm going to have these up here afterwards for you to come see if you want. "Am I Really a Christian?" And then Joel Beakey has been working on this since the 80s. A lot of the ladies did the DVD study. Here's a book that he did, and his new systematic theology has a chapter on it. Beakey on knowing and growing and assurance of faith. And then a really helpful one from an author that I love everything I've ever read from him, Jerry Bridges. This is The Gospel for Real Life. And this is where that phrase came from, preach the gospel to yourself every day. It came from Jerry Bridges and his work in this book. So I'll have these up here. Let me just encourage you to do like Christian and put your gaze on the atonement, on the cross, on the gospel, and dig into it and let it have its rooting effect in your heart. Let me close this in prayer to have God help us with that.